Okay, so today I'm with Clint, and he's at Selected Wisdom, and we're going to talk about Al-Shabaab. So over the weekend, there was this pretty significant attack on the Westgate Mall in Nairobi, Kenya. And sort of in our previous series in dealing with Somalia, we haven't really talked about Shabaab and counterterrorism. And so today, we're going to sort of, Clint will help us puzzle through and sort of try to understand, the significance of not only the Westgate attack, but sort of put Shabaab within a greater counterterrorism context and sort of try to figure out, where do they stand vis-a, U.S. counterterrorism policy and sort of the greater region and, the greater, security outlook for the region. So let me start off with, describe the Westgate attack to us. I mean, I think in the media, just me flipping through the news, it was an attack on a mall and there was hostages, and I think it might be still going on, or they recently ended it, but sort of describe the attack to us. What
Right.
happened?
Right. So, I mean, from what I know is mostly from, what I've read or seen, on the news, but it is an attack that's everybody has feared for a long time. There was lots of alerts put out about Al-Qaeda wanting to attack shopping malls, from the 2001 on period. And we saw the Mumbai attacks, which, use conventional weapons, more of a conventional approach, and the idea was, much like in the case of Westgate, was let's kill as many people as we can, but also at the same time let's control the media cycle and make this endure as long as possible. So for maximum effect, we don't want to just kill a lot of people. We don't want to just detonate a suicide bomb. We want to kill and occupy and make the siege last as long as possible so we can sort of, make it aware. What's interesting about it is it took a significant amount of planning. And obviously, a support network of some sort to pull this attack off. Like anything, in the media that comes out of the Horn of Africa, you always have to take it with a grain of salt because it's an interesting media environment where there's a lot of propaganda being put out by many different sides. But from what can be gathered so far, on Muslims. And even above, non-Muslim Kenyans, they wanted to target Westerners, and they killed a lot of people just using, basic weapons. But there's been stories that they had a crew-served weapon, which is a, a belt-fed, multi-person, manned machine gun of some sort that was pre-planted inside, which made it very difficult then for the Kenyan forces. So they essentially did what would be known as an urban defense inside that mall, and it sounds like they had to actually demolished several floors. Sound like three floors collapsed one on top of another. And what's interesting now is I'm not positive that anybody really knows who the attackers were, or how many there were. I think they reported five attackers were killed, 11 were taken into custody, but who's to say some of them didn't slip out with a lot of the people that were in the mall and make their way out, just by blending in. So some reports, in the media are like, oh, this is a sign that Shabaab is on a different game plan and that they've risen with this attack. But that's not entirely true either. There have been a lot of attacks in Mogadishu that use a similar game plan. Shabaab uses a mix of suicide bombings, but they've also done armed attacks where they arm and occupy on UN and Somali government facilities. So it's not surprising that they did this. And I've seen a lot of analysis like, oh, so this happened in Mumbai, so now this is happening in Nairobi. And it doesn't take a big leap to replicate an attack like that. It's a very soft target. It doesn't require any advanced technology. It does require a lot of planning, and you do have to have access to the facility and usually the support of insiders to pull that off. So that is interesting and serious. But Shabaab isn't a rookie organization in terms of pulling off big terrorist attacks in cities.
So, I mean, what would be the motivation for attacking a mall like this? I mean, it seems like we've heard multiple sort of arguments. A mall was sort of, a Western symbol. And then another sort of slice of that argument says that Amal was an indication of sort of Nairobi and Kenya at large becoming this economic powerhouse in the Horn. You know, what are some of the motivations for attacking Amal?
Well, it's easy targets. You know, it's lightly defended. It's not like attacking a government building where you have a large security force out there. The other one, it is distinctly Western in the sense that, you know, there are a lot of Western businesses and companies there. There were even claims that some of the businesses were Israeli owned. I don't know if that's true or not, but if you look at Al-Qaeda's operation at the Paradise Hotel and when they tried to shoot down an Israeli charter jet in 2002, that would, you know, line up pretty well in terms of their motivations for that. The other thing, it could just literally come down to where they had insiders too who could help them, or a facilitation network that could help them. But obviously they were correct in the selection of their target because they held it for 4 days.
So, I mean, you know, how much of this, you know, during the attack, you know, let me walk that back a bit. You know, describe the media approach when they were attacking, because I think it was on Saturday or Sunday we started reading reports about they were live tweeting the attack from, I think it was HSM Press or one of those accounts. But
right.
So, I mean, walk us through, I mean, you know, how is that possible that they could live tweet something like that? And then B, what is sort of the intention of that sort of live tweeting?
Right. I mean, first off, we don't know that they were actually live tweeting that. They could have just been making a lot of that up, or they could have just been watching, you know, live TV news and just saying things. And there's been a lot of false Twitter feeds, as you've seen, put out there by, you know, Shabab supporters or Shabab copycats. But Shabab's, you know, been active on social media for a long time now. They're really the first one to gravitate towards Twitter. And what is not, it seems to be lost in a lot of the Western media, is they move to that platform because that's how people in that region can communicate the easiest. There's not as deep internet penetration by laptops or computers. It's not that easy to get on. But what people do have is phones, where they can use and access Twitter. And, you know, in that region of the world, a lot of things, to include even money transfers, happen by text message or happen by Twitter. And they use Facebook as their main interface to the internet. At the time, you know, when the internet was growing in that region, Facebook already essentially had already been on the scene. So instead of going and saying Google is my interface to the internet the way a lot of people did in the 90s, for them, Facebook was their first intermediary. So they've had a strong social media presence, but I think that's also because they didn't have the technological capability to broadcast over more protected forums, like you've seen with other Al-Qaeda sort of supporters who put up forums that are password protected, you have to get a membership, that sort of a thing. So it's created this sort of free-for-all environment on Twitter where Shabab can reach out to their whole global diaspora, they can reach out to their core audience in Somalia or even in Kenya. So I think that's why they've gravitated and used it so much. There's a lot of cultural and regional factors about that. In terms of how they use it in live tweet, I don't think it's the advantage that it's being portrayed in a lot of the open source, you know, publications that are being written about it. Sure, it does give them a voice. If you look at who follows that account, it's a lot of journalists. That's not a surprise. I mean, it's easy for journalists to then get, you know, access to that information, and it's easy then for Shabab to put out their message because they've got reporters and journalists that are right there at their hands. So that's one of the main objectives of terrorism, is, you know, to set the agenda with your message and control the media. So they've done that very, very well, especially through this attack. However, there's a big downside on this social media stuff, especially with Twitter, and that it has sort of democratized what the message is. So a lot of Shabab supporters are very young. Some of them aren't actually with Shabab. They're located around the region or even globally. And they say a lot of things that are out of line probably with what Shabab would want them to say. And so occasionally we even see in Twitter, some of the Shabab supporters will say, hey, they told us not to talk about that, so quit talking about it. So it's very difficult for them to control that message, which is different from a lot of the forums where they just delete the messages or they suspend accounts or whatever it might be. So it does have an adversarial effect, and you can see people engaging back and forth, and you can see them trying to police themselves, but they can't really because people are 18 and they're in London or whatever, and they're not really there on the inside circle with, most of Shabab's leaders. So it's an interesting dynamics playing out. Everybody thinks because they have a Twitter account that they must be more powerful and it's a great thing. But I kind of see the reverse. I see a lot of strain from message, and it's very difficult for them to control.
And we'll get to sort of the
Yeah,
details.
number one being Omar Hamami. I mean,
Right.
he's openly bashing them, and they're in engagements and arguments, in social media. That would be much, much more difficult for somebody like Hamami to pull off if he was strictly limited to forums.
And for the audience, we'll get to that towards the end and
Yeah.
sort of get into recruitment and whatnot, but back to the Westgate attack. I'm sort of curious. This wasn't in Somalia; it was in Kenya, which is
Right.
obvious. So, I mean, explain sort of why Kenya. I mean, is it really? Was this attack really stemming from the invasion of Kenya's invasion of Somalia, or was it sort of really just terrorism, attacking a Western symbol, attacking a sort of symbol of wealth and prosperity?
It's both. I mean, it's obviously in response to Kenya, spending the past 2 years repelling Shabaab in southern Somalia. That's for sure. And, the motivation is one to conduct a rear area attack on Kenya, but at the same point, see if we can get from their perspective, see if we can get Kenyan military to either come down oppressively in southern Somalia, which would rally local clans that Shabaab has lost back to their cause, or that they'll come down harshly inside the country against Somali refugees, which there are many, and on Kenyan Muslims potentially that they believe are facilitating. And there's always been a tenuous relationship between Kenyan Muslims and the central government. So, I mean, those are the most direct sort of Shabab things. But also in terms of Kenya as a target, they've got a 20-year history of being infiltrated or targeted by Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab, going all the way back to 1992, 3, and 4, Al-Qaeda was landing operatives in Nairobi. They were taken off from the Wilson Airport and going straight into Somalia to work with clans there. They were coming down to the Kenya coast and moving from Mombasa up to Lamu and then up to Ras Kamboni into southern Somalia. So this pattern has been there. You have the 98 attacks where they attacked the embassy. You have the 2002 attacks where they attacked the Paradise Hotel. And you have this attack now. So Kenya has always had it is a weaker state in terms of their security posture. They have, Somalis and lesser refugee populations moving through the country. So it's a target that they can hit. Whereas Ethiopia, for example, who's invaded them, it's much more difficult for them to penetrate into Ethiopia. One, because of the harsh terrain and, conditions getting from southern Somalia up to a real target like Addis. But at the same point, the Ethiopian state is very heavy-handed and tightly controlled, and they don't have those, refugee populations in as great a numbers that could facilitate an operation like this.
How much does refugees, Somali refugees in Kenya, play in sort of in the operations of Shabaab? I mean, is this sort of a transnational connection to where they can operate, they can operate in Kenya because of the refugees and because of sort of the connection of the diaspora and the refugees to Somalia?
I mean, we won't know until we know a lot about the attack, in terms of deep details. But it has been a constant worry, over the past, really since about January 2007 when Ethiopia invaded Somalia. It's been a persistent worry that Somali, diaspora populations in Kenya would, whether they know it or not, have, Shabab operatives in their mix. They'd be able to infiltrate. And yeah, I would also think that they have a group essentially an affiliate, Shabab does, in Kenya called the Muslim Youth Center. And at Ibn Sakili, Chris Anzalone, he wrote a really good article in the CTC Sentinel about that group, Muslim Youth Center, which is essentially a Kenyan affiliate or a Kenyan version of Shabab. So it could come out that they were involved in terms of supporting this attack. You know, I don't know. But they've definitely been a presence on social media, putting out Shabab propaganda, being a supporter at a time when Shabab was really getting their butt kicked, you know, out of every city, every major city, at least, in southern Somalia.
So I want to sort of shift gears and get into a thematic issue. So I think a lot of people have been arguing, you know, there's I'll sort of characterize these broadly. So on one side is saying, this is, you know, Shabab resurgent. This is, you know, they're coming back. These are big terror. The Westgate Mall is an indication of a return to big terror attacks. And this is, you know, this is what's going to be the pattern from here on out. And then there's another set of arguments that from analysts, it's basically saying that this is really desperation. They've lost a lot of territory in Somalia. And so now they have to engage in these big attacks, you know, as a show of force and as a show of desperation. What is your read on the situation? I mean, is, you know, do we consider these attacks, you know, as a sign of Shabab that is sort of not only resurgent, but sort of stronger than ever?
Right. Well, there's several different facets to this. The first one that I think is interesting is the same day there was the attack on the Westgate Mall, there was major attacks in Iraq and Pakistan that killed more people. So this just illustrates how important the media is in this whole terrorism atmosphere. You know, they chose to follow the Kenya attack because it was a better story. And because of that, Shabab's got greater chances of essentially being successful with this attack. The other thing is, you know, there's a lot more counterterrorism analysts and terrorism analysts 10 years after 9/11, and there's a lot fewer issues to be covered. You know, it used to be everybody was talking about Iraq or everybody was talking about Afghanistan. So it's interesting, you know, this attack occurred. It was a successful attack from, you know, just a tactical standpoint. But what might actually make it a strategic success for Shabab is there's been so much coverage of it. So it's interesting that, you know, from their perspective, they used terrorism exactly in the way it was designed for. They attacked outside of the region on a target that had a lot of international parties. So it wasn't just, you know, Somalis on Kenyans or Somalis on Somalis. It was Somalis on Kenyans and Westerners of all different types. And the other thing is they made it endure, so they turned it into a story. And if you've taken terrorism class, and I'm sure anybody that has read Inside Terrorism, this is exactly what Bruce Hoffman lays out in his Motivations for Terrorism. This is a classic case study of it. But right now it's still in the tactical phase. And so to know whether this will be a strategic success comes down to several factors. So if you want to know in the end who's right, is, you know, Al-Shabaab resurgent or is Al-Shabaab weaker, I think we got to look at, will there be more attacks of significant size, not just throwing a hand grenade in a parking lot or something, you know, attacks of significant size over the next weeks and months. That would mean there's a resurgent Al-Shabaab and that they have a support network in Kenya and they can carry on a campaign. The other one then will be, what is the Kenyan state's response? Do they come down heavy-handed in southern Somalia and heavy-handed in Kenya, which then drives people to support Shabab again at a time when they're really down? If they do, that would be a sign of strength. The third one will be, and this is, you know, kind of hard to see or hard to understand, is what will be the popular support that's generated just from this attack alone. So will there be Kenyan Muslims that come out and support Shabab? If we see them sort of condoning the attack or not really coming out against it, then that could be worrisome. But if Kenyan Muslims say, hey, look, we're Kenyans and you're also killing Muslims in this attack and we're not a part of this, which is what happened after the 98 embassy bombing and the 2002 attacks, then that wouldn't be a good sign for Shabab, and that would be better, you know, for us. And then the other extension of that is the global diaspora. So the global diaspora has seen Shabab, you know, retreat into southern Somalia. They've seen foreign fighters being killed by Shabab. These are foreign fighters that joined Shabab. So I would have to think support throughout the global diaspora has waned. It'll never go away entirely because there's a lot of clan relationships there. But it definitely, has waned probably in comparison. So those are the four things I would look for. And it depends on what direction those four things go. I think that decides whether this is, a big success and a resurgence in Al-Shabaab or if this is their sort of dying gasp, which is what I talked about in that article. My guess is it's the latter. They needed to pull off an attack for several different reasons. One, they've been on the decline for a long time. And if you want to get your support back up, and this is Al-Qaeda's central problems right now, if you really want to get people, excited about you, you better be doing attacks. No attacks, people start to lose interest. People want to be supporting winners. They don't want to be supporting losers. And so if you're a terrorist organization, you better be doing something. And, right alongside with that, what the future holds and the way it goes, I think we got to look at those four indicators and then compare that with what was going on in Shabab internally. Just 3 or 4 weeks ago, they had, splinters of Al-Shabaab that were fighting each other. Forces under Robo were fighting forces under the Emir of Shabab, Godane. Last week, or 2 weeks ago, I guess now, you've got the killing of Omar Hamami, their most famous foreign fighter, and several other foreign fighters, which was kind of a misunderstood that Hamami was alone. He was not alone. There were others out there. So that's not an indication of a strong terrorist organization.
So, I mean, let's look at it. I mean, do you consider the Westgate attack a shift in strategy? Because, I mean, as a layman, it seems like Shabab has switched, or at least has sort of moved from holding territory and building institutions to an insurgency to now, using big terror attacks. I mean, is there a fluidity between those three roles, or do we consider, Shabab only really being able to do maybe one or two of those things and then, leaving its other, other sort of forms of attack on the side?
Right. I mean, it's a continuum. So they went from being able to hold turf, being the governing body, being able to conduct conventional warfare, against the Somali or then the transitional federal government and Kenyan forces, Ethiopian forces. As they lost, they retreated. You want to use your resources wisely. You shift to unconventional warfare, and that's what they did. And that really happened about a year ago when they finally lost Kismayo to the Kenyan military. That was like their major, city that they still held, and it was a major port, which was important for a lot of the economic and resource factors for them. They, really controlled the charcoal trade, which brought them a lot of revenue. That port in and of itself is the hub for the local economy. Fishing is big. So there's a, smuggling, black market, everything went in and out of there. So when they lost that, they lost an important resource pipeline. So what do they do when they have to retreat? And, Hamami talked about this in his biography and sort of the disputes. People didn't want to shift back to this terrorist attacks and, unconventional warfare. They wanted to, a lot of the clans wanted to negotiate and settle and protect their losses, essentially. They lost some ground, so why lose everything by continuing this fight? So the shift you see has been going on really for a year. And in terms of external terrorist attacks, it seems like a lot of people forgot. I noticed in the somebody's talking about the Kilcullen article, he sort of overlooked that they had pulled off a suicide bombing in Kampala, Uganda in 2010. So this isn't the first time they've done it. And they probably had, I don't know, 50 to 75 or so small incidents attributed to them in Kenya over the past year. And this will continue to go on. Something else that's not really being talked about, you hear the usual sort of tough talk, oh, we got to get in there and fix it and eradicate Shabab forever. That is not going to happen. The state we're at right now is probably as good as it gets. They've been pushed out of all the major cities. They've been restricted in terms of resources. But, one of the points they always teach in a lot of the African history classes is that, African governments are notoriously unable to project power much very much far out of their capital cities. Because one, the land doesn't hold very much, and two, they don't have the resources or even the reason to go out there in the hinterlands and try and secure that. So maybe like Kenya or somebody can really oppress this, but what's more likely to happen is what we've seen the past couple months. Somali government tries to transition to governance rather than fighting. You know, you got the Kenyan military, Ethiopian military, they're wanting to figure out like, okay, when can we withdraw and sort of leave a stabilizing force that's kosher with us, you know, that we can keep our influence in. And then they're left out in the hinterlands, which gives them a safe haven to do terrorist attacks, mobilize people to, you know, attack Mogadishu, Nairobi, key epicenters, and they slowly try and chip away and build up their support again so that they can move the continuum back the other way to where they're governing, you know, they're using conventional military, they're stabilizing. And this is an ebb and flow. It goes like this in Somalia and other parts of Africa, you know, over and over and over again. So when I see a lot of the articles that talk about, oh, we've lost or we're not applying ourselves to this conflict, well, what do we really intend to do is my question. What do we expect? This is kind of about the best we can probably do, at least in the near term and even strategically. I don't know how we govern southern Somalia, and I don't think anyone really has a solution for that.
I mean, I think you hit on something very important. I mean, how would you describe sort of U.S. counterterrorism policy towards Shabab? I mean, it seems like
yeah. The whole Horn of Africa region was really a precursor to how I think we're seeing counterterrorism unfold post Iraq, Afghanistan. So, you know, Ethiopia invading, there were a lot of people talking about how we needed to get in there, you know, as part of our counterterrorism effort and flush out Shabab and, you know, do great things, win hearts and minds, you know, stabilize the country. That was huge there in that 2007-08 period. And I think the U.S. made a wise decision, which was to really be cautious, pick and choose how you're going to support, use other aspects of national power other than the military to support. And, you know, they plugged away. They would interdict occasionally on key al-Qaeda leaders. People wanted all the way back to the 98 bombings in some cases. They provided support in terms of intelligence, you know, diplomatic, economic, and law enforcement's a big one that's not really talked about much. And they worked with a lot of international partners. And so I think that's what you're seeing unfold. They're trying to replicate that model in a lot of other places now. But I think it's a smart strategy because beyond terrorism, there's not a huge U.S. strategic interest in Somalia or the Horn of Africa. You know, it provides a target to our adversaries. But other than that, other than Westerners traveling in those regions, we really have to be cautious about getting overextended, which is exactly what those terrorist groups want. They want us to come and occupy so that that way they can target us, build popular support around their cause, and repulse, you know, foreign intervention. So I really think the Horn of Africa example is a precursor to what we're seeing in a lot of other places right now.
I mean, sort of, I think a lot of the U.S. approach has been critiqued, though, especially in the Horn. I think somebody like Jeremy Scahill, who's written Dirty Wars, would say that this approach really hasn't necessarily been effective, but rather has sort of magnified the problem of disorder and institution building. So, I mean,
right.
How would you, I mean, you know, even, you know, just doing research for this interview, I mean, it seems like, you know, building up militias and using drone strikes and sort of viewing the problem much more from the lens of military and
right.
Sort of punch counterterrorism, very much more, you know, kill capture counterterrorism as opposed to institution building counterterrorism, that the problem has been sort of magnified. I mean, how would you sort of answer this critique and sort of, you know, answer this critique?
Right. This comes down to several things. One, we seem to only have an end state in mind that is everything should look like a U.S. democracy. There should be a Starbucks, Next Day Blinds, Cold Stone Creamery, you know, somewhere on the horizon, you know, that looks very stable, And that's the best way to pursue it. I think in a lot of places, and this will probably aggravate a lot of governance folks, a lot of places, the best solutions are local solutions. And democracy requires some underlying conditions to be successful. And stability is about more than just institutions. Stability is also about, you know, economic stability, and growth and governance opportunities come from that. The other thing that's a big part of it is social capital, which is the, you know, the horizontal linkages between people which allow for those institutions to be effective. And in a lot of these places, you have harsh environments with very little economic opportunity. You have clan and tribal networks that are dependent on resource control. And so you don't have those overlapping linkages. So anytime you build an institution, let's say we actually built institutions in a lot of these places, what you would find is whoever has the most people in their clan, what happens if you vote? They win. And whenever they win, what do? They institute their dominance. And so our system, you know, if you read, you know, Tocqueville, Democracy in America, it was really, you know, three pillars there. You know, the capacity for economic growth, the development of institutions based on voting, and the third one was, you know, generating social capital, overlapping linkages, which, you know, helps those institutions and the economy grow. And we don't have the ability to do that in these regions or these places. And in the absence of the tools to do it, in the absence of the will to do it, and with it not being in our strategic interest, I think the best we can do is protect what we see as our, you know, American or U.S. interests, if it's a U.S. thing, or if it's a global counterterrorism thing, the same thing. And in places, I mean, of all the regions where we've done development work that it's actually maybe been successful, it's the Horn of Africa. I mean, the biggest component of our CT approach, if you looked at the distribution on that sort of diplomatic humanitarian one, if we've done it anywhere, percentage-wise, has actually been in the Horn of Africa. That's the main, you know, mission that you see from, you know, Special Operations Command. A lot of them is how do we work with partners and do development. In fact, the only military people I saw when I was in Kenya were civil affairs teams that were digging wells. So it's kind of interesting. Whereas everywhere else I've ever gone, you know, it's a lot more of the snake eaters and, you know, super killers that are out there. I understand their points. I mean, I definitely respect Jeremy's work and, you know, Greg Johnson, we have the same debate about Yemen, you know, what is the CTU approach going to be? But, you know, what really is our objectives? And that's what I kind of appreciate about other governments to a certain extent, is they're more clear about what their objectives are. In the U.S., we tend to be a little bit more opaque about what our interests really are in these different countries.
So, you know, back to the idea of sort of local solutions and sort of local, sort, you know, finding the solution within the political milieu of the country itself. I mean, I think in our conversation with Armin, you know, he was discussing, you know, there's a big market of remittances going across,
Huge.
huge, right? But I think the point he made to us is that you have treasury. And you have a lot of these counterterrorism laws that deal with money laundering. So I'm not an attorney, so I'll just sort of
Right.
give these generally, you know, money laundering, money transference, and that a lot of these laws are sort of being used to shut down, you know, the transfer of money from either, you know, what is legitimate money. So it's not, you know, drug money or anything, but it's, you know, somebody sending money from the Gulf or from Minneapolis back to Somalia. So I'm sort of curious. I mean, you know, okay, we're back. There's snafu, I guess. So basically, my question was, you know, where do, you know, if the search is for local solutions and sort of remittances are a huge part of, you know,
Local solutions,
local
right?
solutions, I mean, where do we put sort of counterterrorism law and sort of, you know, law that you think would be used to stop terrorism, but it also, you know, cuts into remittances and legitimate sort of transference of money.
Right. And one of the worst cases of that going wrong, I think, is in Somalia. I forget the name of the charity or foundation. It's called Al something. But That was one of the first ones they went after, and it had a very adverse effect. And so I think it's gone well when it's about freezing assets or accounts of known, designated foreign terrorists. I think it's gone poorly when it's sort of broad brush, let's stop, flows into a certain region. And that was the approach, I think, in the early days after 9/11. Everything was very broad brush. Certain locations are terrorist safe havens, so we need to shut it down. And that's where things go wrong, because you can't use absolutes on any of these things. But terrorist finance, interdicting that is one of our more effective tools, and it's used well when it's used nimbly, and is very, surgical in its application. I don't think it goes well when it's very broad brushed. And you saw that a lot after 9/11. There was a lot of debate about Hezbollah and Hamas charities and finance and what they're really being used for. And, when does something become licit versus illicit, or when is it supporting terrorism or not supporting terrorism? It's very hard to tell without a lot of investigation.
So, but I mean, it almost seems like, a lot of, it almost seems like, it's better to err on the side of caution than it
Yeah.
is. And it seems when that,
I would say that's where it's at, in its current state, probably. As opposed to 10 years ago, where it was on the more aggressive side. I mean, I don't see the kind of large scale interdiction. At least I'm not aware of it. Maybe it's going on. I'm not a treasury expert, but I don't get the sense that all remittances are being cut off to Somalia, for example.
So I want to sort of get into the idea of looking at this from a regional perspective. Where do we, in US strategy, in USCT strategy, where do we put, let's see, we've mentioned in the show, we've mentioned Kenya, we've mentioned Ethiopia, and we've mentioned Uganda. So,
Right.
I mean, where do we put those three countries? And I'm assuming their security posture and their security structure is very different between the three. So, where do we put, how do we understand, the US's counterterrorism policy and strategy in relation to those three countries as it relates to Somalia?
Right. I mean, it's not entirely clear, all the actions that are undertaken, but the Joint Task Force, in the Horn of Africa really is a coordinating sort of effort. They're working with a lot of foreign allies and partners. Each of them have different capacities and capabilities. I think a lot of it is overstated too, especially a lot of people had put out in the media right after Kenya invaded that that was all under U.S. pressure. Now, I don't think that's the case at all. I think Kenya made that, decision independently. But at the same point, I would hope that from a counterterrorism perspective, they're a partner and we're working with them and supporting them and also trying to help them, restrain their operations whenever they can become, overly aggressive. And I think that's probably the case, for the most part.
So I want to get to the last sort of most controversial part of Al-Shabaab, and that's foreign recruitment. So
Right.
I think immediately after the Westgate attacks, there was, or even not even immediately after, it was actually during that people started, there was a nasty little rumor that was going around that some people within
The
this
White Widow, right?
the White Widow.
That's an amazing story. You can almost see the TV special that will come out of that. Yeah.
I think one rumor was they're Americans, like five or six Americans, but I think there's, those are rumors, but there's some truth to that Shabab does do recruitment from outside of Somalia. So I mean,
Absolutely. Absolutely. They've been the most successful Al-Qaeda affiliate in terms of drawing out West people from the West. I don't even know if I should call them Westerners, but from the United States, Canada, and Europe. And that's really because they can draw from the global diaspora population. Everywhere there's Somali populations and large concentrations, we've kind of seen foreign fighters recruited from those populations. So they've been very successful with that. And I think that was one of the main motivators after bin Laden died for Zawahiri to actually conduct the merger officially with al-Shabaab, is he wanted to tap into that foreign fighter pipeline so that he could sort of select or redirect foreign fighters to do operations against the West, because they actually have visas, they can get back into the country, and they have networks on the ground in those countries.
What is the pitch that Shabab makes to? Let me flip it this way. If I'm a Somalia, Somalia, if I'm a Somali, a member of this diaspora in Minneapolis or in London, what is attracting people to fight for Shabab? What is, I mean.
You've got several different pressures. The first one, I think, is, family, social, and cultural. So they're part of clans that are fighting back in their home country, where they came from. And we've seen this with, almost every foreign fighter conflict. If you read like David Millett's stuff, he goes through, and it has to do with a connection to that conflict. And the number one thing is, immigration, global immigration, where those communities end up, and they still have a connection back there. And with that, number two, the thing that's different, in modern day is they keep very tight communications with each other, even compared to 20 years ago. So when something happens in Mogadishu or in Somalia, you actually see conflicts play out, all over the world in those diaspora communities that mirror whatever's going on. There's some great cases, I think, in San Diego, where there are rival clans men fighting each other in San Diego over something that was happening between their clans in Somalia. So they have a very tight connection. So that's one of the reasons why they're able to recruit. Number two, it's heavy ethnicity. So while they say, oh, they've been able to recruit the most foreign fighters, they've been able to recruit a lot of Somali foreign fighters who are from the global diaspora. The Minnesota case is the one everybody talks about the most in the U.S., where there are, I think it's like up to 40, between 20 and 40, maybe it's up to 50 now. But they've consistently been able to do that. And that's a very similar story to what we've seen in Europe. It's one of the only ones that we've seen, prop up similarly in the U.S., is that second and third generation, not well integrated into the, U.S. environment. They are looking for something to get behind. They want to grow up to be like their parents who were fighting, for their families and clans, back in Somalia. And so they get excited about this. And you see that sort of, growth aspect of when lots of guys get together and they, sort of socially pressure themselves into it. In that same mix of foreign fighters, you do get the anomalies, which are the ones and twos from around the U.S. that end up there, like the Omar Hamami, the Maldonado case. Those guys also got up into that pipeline around that 2006 time period and 2007. I think 2007 is when Maldonado got caught. 2006-07 is also when Hamami made his way over there. And those guys were in a group that essentially went in through Toronto, ended up in Cairo, and then ended up in Somalia. And that probably a lot of it had to do with how difficult, if you look at it from their perspective, one, a lot of them were attracted. These are the very Western, the American guys with no connection to Somalia. They were attracted to it's a pure Islamic state. Shabab, as opposed to the others, the Islamic Courts Union at that time was actually operating an Islamic state, as opposed to some of these other foreign fighter conflicts where they were just battling it out. Number two, the other attraction probably was you weren't necessarily as likely to get killed right away if you ended up in Somalia. So, people always think that all foreign fighters initially take off and all they want to do is seek martyrdom. It really is a gradual process. So if you're going to pick your conflict, you might as well pick one where you might not get, whacked as soon as you come off the bus. Whereas in Iraq, those guys were expiring very, very quickly around that time. And the third one is easy ease of access. So Somalia was a place, while very difficult to get to, relatively it was easier to get to than Western Anbar Province if you're coming all the way from the United States. So that's part of it too, I think. So it's kind of those three factors.
So I'm sort of curious on Omar Hamami. Is this how you pronounce it?
That's how I pronounce it. I'm not sure how he'd pronounce it. I'd have to listen to his tapes, but yeah.
I'm sort of curious. I mean, the circumstances of his death seem to point to that, you know, in our even within our previous bit of our conversation, he was killed by Al-Shabaab itself. There wasn't a drone strike. There wasn't, you know, SEAL Team 6, so to speak. The organization itself killed him. So, I mean,
Correct.
you know, walk us through that fracture. I mean, was it because he was so much on Twitter or?
No. I mean, it's not like your parents being mad when you're on Twitter or something like that. No, this was, I mean, this goes back to really the evolution of the breakup comes from the merger. If you read Hamami's bio, which is a miserable read because it's very long and windy, and it could use a very good edit. But what you do find in there is that a couple different things. One, the merger was really pushed by Godane, Ahmed Godane. He is the emir now, and he really pushed that in that February 2011, I think, time frame. I could be a little bit off on the dates, but he pushed that merger as a way to sort of shore up his power vis-a-vis the other clan leaders. And when he pushed that merger through, he sort of forced it on all the leaders. He basically had them all show up at a meeting, except for Robo, his main ally, or his main adversary inside Shabaab. And he sort of said, "Hey, we're going to join Al Qaeda. You need to swear loyalty to me. I'm going to swear loyalty to Al Qaeda." And all the leaders, according to Omar, were pretty nervous. They thought they were getting shammed. Like there really wasn't an Al Qaeda out there he was communicating with. Maybe he was just telling a story to get them to swear loyalty to him so he could use it as a tool against him. This is very Game of Thrones, by the way. So, you know, that happened. A lot of people were upset about it. And especially some of the foreign fighters were very upset about it. Now, in the background, right before this, there had been a lot of push and pull back and forth about the Al Qaeda guys who were in their midst. So Harun Fazul was there, and he was, as we learned from I think some of the Michelle Shepard pieces, we were learning that he was trying to set up a foreign fighter training capability in Somalia to send people back to London to conduct attacks in London, or that at least is how the story goes. And Godane didn't like that. He didn't like having, you know, real Al Qaeda guys from Al Qaeda Central in his midst. So after all this is going on, the merger goes through. People aren't real happy with it. It takes 2 or 3 weeks, I think, for Zawahiri to come back out with a confirmation message. So a lot of the leaders were nervous underneath him, wondering, "Hey, is this really? Did I really swear allegiance to Al Qaeda, or is this all just a big sham?" You know, for Godane to get control, but he eventually does. And then you see a lot of the Al Qaeda guys get killed off in rapid succession. Fazul stumbles into a checkpoint in Somalia after being on the run for more than, you know, 20 years in the Horn of Africa. He suddenly just drives into a checkpoint and he's killed. Then several other Al Qaeda guys that are the foreign fighters get killed by drones. And Raffaello Pantucci just had a great article that came out about Burjawi, who was a guy from the UK. He gets killed by a drone. Soccer gets killed, I believe, by a drone. And you see these foreign fighters start to get killed. At the same point, you see some tensions arise. And according to Hamami's story, he goes to Godane and says, "Hey, we don't like how you're treating, you know, the foreign fighters. There's kind of a rift." And I think this is according to Omar, and this kind of shows how dumb he is. He says, "And I think maybe Robo should take over," which is Godane's main adversary. And this puts him at odds with Godane, who had told him to stay out of politics. And so he thinks Hamami is working behind his back. And that's when we see this, you know, a little over a year and a half ago, Hamami comes out with this video where he's on the run and he puts up the YouTube video and says he's being hunted by Shabaab. And really, that was the first sign, you know, of all this breakup and dissension that was going on in the ranks. The assumption right then when it happened was that Hamami was alone. He was the only one. But Hamami's complaints were that Godane, you know, was not using the foreign fighters correctly. He was supporting his local Somali fighters over the foreign fighters, that he was using COT and taxing it. Or he wasn't using COT, but he was using the funds from COT, which is illegal. under Sharia law from Hamami's perspective, and he was taxing it. And then also that Godain had strayed from, Islamic law. He didn't have the right to do what he was doing, and that he was corrupt. And so there's a big break, and then another bio comes out, and one of the things he talks about is that a couple other foreign fighters that were his direct leaders were killed suspiciously, shot in the back on the battlefield. And that was because they had pushed back against Godain. So then you see Omar on the run, essentially, all the way from, I guess it was like March of 12, all the way to like January this year. And that's when he resurfaced again. He had been, initially he had been in public just hanging out, but, avoiding Shabab. And then he was actually on the run and in hiding. Starting in January, feared for his life. They had sort of told him to give up his weapon, which he took as a sign that they were going to kill him. They had tried to arrange special meetings with him, things like that. And then just back in May time period, it seems like they started to close in on him. They tried to kill him with an assassin. They shot him. That was the picture in the throat. A lot of people have seen he was shot in the throat. He escaped from that one. But in that meantime, there, a lot of the Shabab leaders had broken with Godain. Very key ones. Ibrahim al-Afghani, who was Godain's deputy, broke and put up an actual plea on a Al-Qaeda forum requesting that Zawahiri replace Godain as leader of Shabab. And after a few weeks, Godain actually goes after Afghani and kills him, has him killed, him and a couple other leaders. They also lost Hassan Awais, who is a nationalist leader who's been around for a long, long time, was tied in with AIAI and the Islamic Courts Union, and ran his own sort of outfit there. He breaks with them and actually is now under in custody, I believe, with the Somali national government. And then you also have Robo, who has his militias who are battling it out. And then just, the past 2 or 3 weeks, you see Hamami die. So that really speaks to those who keep talking about a resurgent Shabab. I don't know how you explain those things in the context of resurgence. I mean, that's fracturing and problems in your organization. I don't think those are signs of being stronger. Anytime you're spending as much time killing your own members as you are fighting your adversary, I think that's probably not a time of strength.
So to layer on to this political fracturing, I mean, each one of these guys, I mean, it strikes me that each one of these guys has a tw his own Twitter account.
Right, which goes back to that communication thing we were talking about earlier.
Right. So, I mean, how do
Is
they?
it their greatest strength or their Achilles heel? Yeah.
Right. I mean, sort of expand upon this. I mean, it strikes me as, they're very media savvy, but at the same time, they can't really, control that, the individual accounts of, members of the group. I mean, I think with Omar, he was infamous. I mean, he live tweeted his hit. I mean, when they came to
Yeah,
kill him,
when
he.
he got shot in the neck, I mean, it was out within minutes. Yeah.
And so, I mean, as an organization, how do they, create message discipline, so to speak?
That's right. So they have the same problem that the US government does with their workers who use social media, which is if they go off and say something stupid, how does that reflect on the government, right? I mean, we've seen this around DC, at least I have, people getting concerned about guys in the ranks or soldiers posting things on YouTube, stuff like that. We've seen a lot of these stories. And they have the same sort of discipline problems, and but they have only one way of solving those, and that's violence. That is extreme discipline that's killing people. And they don't actually have access to everybody that's their supporter on Twitter. So in the US government, if you say something stupid on Twitter, you can, feel the repercussions through disciplinary action the next day. But if you're a diaspora member and a foreign fighter who's gone to Somalia, fought for a while, and now you're located somewhere else around the world, like Yemen, and you start chiming in and you're saying something either out of line with Godain or directly against him, Godain has no way to control that. There's nothing he can do other than try and go through the diaspora to try and have that guy shut up. So, Twitter has been great for Shabab getting out their message, But it's also presented this whole new way of countering Shabab in a way, or exploiting the fact that they can't control their message, which hasn't really been talked about very well in the media yet. Jayenberger has talked about it. You've probably seen, some of his posts. He does some really excellent stuff at Foreign Policy on this. But the democratization of ideology on Twitter may not be the best thing if you want to actually keep everybody in line. And I think this is part of the reason why we see Zawahiri putting out sort of his guidance in an open fashion, because he can't figure out how to communicate with everybody just through his sub-leaders.
But, I mean, there's also the flip side of that democratization seems to be that for counterterrorism analysts and sort of people who monitor Twitter, I mean, it was really easy to shut down. I shouldn't say easy, but it was.
Yeah, as soon as they violate the terms of service, those accounts can be shut down. So, in a sense, Shabab is now censoring itself to keep its account up. So, whereas if they had a forum that they controlled, they could put up the craziest, pictures and death and, violence, and they could taunt people. As soon as they start doing that on Twitter, their account gets shut down, and then they have to reestablish and gain followers again. And then they know they can't put that content up. That's what happened when they killed a couple of the French soldiers that went in there for that kidnapping rescue operation. They put the pictures up of the guy that they killed, and that's what got their account suspended one of those times. So, yeah, it becomes like a self-censoring mechanism by actually using that platform.
But I mean, does that make it harder to sort of determine what they're thinking? I mean, it seems like I think at the time of the Westgate attack, somebody critiqued Twitter by I think their argument was by Twitter closing down that main Twitter feed, that feed, you lose intelligence or you lose, insight into how this adversary Shabab tries to shape the media environment. I mean,
I don't think you're losing intelligence. I think you're losing their propaganda outlet. And I've seen way too much of that in the online discussions that we're going to understand Shabab from every 140 characters that they shoot out. I don't think you can do that. It does provide an interesting window. The same could be said of the forums in a certain way. But yeah, I don't think we're losing that much about how Shabab thinks. I mean, Godane is highly prone to violence, more than any other leader probably of an al-Qaeda affiliate. Even, bin Laden was wary of Godane and the Shabab crew, and that's probably why he never went through with a formal merger, because he knew it was very chaotic, it was highly violent, and he couldn't really keep a good handle on what was going on, which is exactly what happened after Zawahiri pushed the merger. So to say we're losing a lot by, shutting down that Twitter account, I don't think we're losing a great intelligence source from the sense that we're going to understand what they're going to do. I can tell you what they're going to do is they're going to kill a lot of people. That's what they do. So I don't need a 140 character stream to tell me that.
so for my last question, I mean, in your time of interacting with Omar, I mean, what did you learn from, I mean, did you as a CT analyst, as somebody, as an analyst, I mean, what did you learn from sort of tweeting with Omar and sort of exchanging with him on a public forum? And what didn't you learn? What was sort of the limitations of that exchange?
Well, I think when people are at the point where they're on a social media forum and they're backing the message, I don't believe at all that you're going to talk someone down from their extremist position by tweeting at them. I don't see that at all. It's too late when it's at that point. Those people are committed, and in a public forum like that, it's like when you get into a shouting match with somebody in a big room. Blood pressure's up, and no one's going to back down from their positions, and so you can use that social media to identify, who those people are and what their positions are. But if you're going to really conduct, violent extremism, countering violent extremism and engagement, then you need to do that face to face, sitting at your desk while you're eating a burrito, shooting off, 140 characters about how the world's great and you just need to calm down isn't going to cut it. And that was really pushed in those CVE days, after the Hassan attack. Part of our strategy was we're going to, do heartwarming tweets and, public messages of happiness, and then we'll suddenly talk these guys down. That's not going to happen. Once they're positioned, you know, and they're in a public debate like that, it's going to be a rarity to establish that. I do think we should do stuff online. I do think we should counter their propaganda, you know, with our own, you know, values and our own messages. But I don't believe in this notion that you're going to de-radicalize people by tweeting or Facebooking them or things like that. I think it gives you good perspective, and you can learn a lot from, you know, what they're talking about and who they communicate with and what they talk about. But I learned from Omar. Hopefully everybody else learned the same thing. You're not going to convince him to turn himself in, and you're not going to convince him to sort of de-escalate. When they're at that point that they're already out there and doing it so publicly, they're not going to back down. So that's one thing, you know, I think I learned. The other thing that I think that was really valuable is to watch how, when terrorists humanize themselves, people start to think that they are no longer the threat that they once were. So it was interesting to watch people on Twitter, you know, interacting with them. And while I would have interactions with them that seemed, you know, more funny, or we'd talk about American stuff, I never doubted that if we were in a room together, Omar would probably want to kill me, or I would want to kill him. You know, so while it was interesting to watch, it was also a little disheartening to see that people kind of would fall. You know, the human side could suddenly cover up a lot of the violence and killing that had been done. And if you read, you know, Omar's bio, one of the interesting things he talks about executing a prisoner in his bio, and that seemed to all kind of wash away as soon as he make a joke about reading Rainbow. So, you know, that was interesting to watch. And then I, you know, kind of wondered if we saw comparative things of criminals or, you know, serial killers, you know, would we warm up to Dexter if he was on Twitter in the same way? You know, that's kind of, it's been an interesting phenomenon to watch. That was something I definitely learned in those conversations.
Interesting. So I think we've sort of come to the end of the interview, and, you know, we always like the guests to have the last word or the last comment. So sort of give us something to chew on before we leave.
The one thing I would say, I think people need to really look at if they're interested in, you know, sort of terrorism, counterterrorism policy, is we got to drop the old paradigms about Al-Qaeda. There's so much going on in the world today that has a regional or cultural dimension in every corner of the earth that's all in our media being called Al-Qaeda. I think that just hurts us severely in the long run. Shabab is so wildly different from Ansar al-Sharia in Libya. You know, AQAP operates differently than Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham or whatever their name is this week, or Nusra, and that we can't go into every one of these conflicts treating our counterterrorism strategy exactly how it is. And I think actually the administration, the way government's going, they kind of know that. But the way it's portrayed in the media is confusing for Americans, and they're starting to lump all of this together. And it doesn't do us good service because there's still a very significant threat that's out there. But we have to be even smarter and more nimble now than we ever were at any time since 9/11 to be successful. So that would be my big takeaway on the terrorism front. And then my only other takeaway is that the Cardinals may clinch the National League Central tonight if the Pirates lose. So that would be something else I tell people to watch out for. Never have we had, I don't think in recent history, not three 90-game winners in one division all going to the playoffs. So go Cardinals. That's my parting shot.
Baseball and terrorism, they sort of blend together.
That's right. Sometimes you got to break away.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
All right, thanks for having me.
Sure.